names and classifications differ in their value and reality. While it's absurd to suppose that there can be much depth of class difference between men called Thomas and men called William, or that there's an ideal and quintessential Thomas or William, yet on the other hand there may be much profounder differences between a white man and a Hottentot, and still more between Homo sapiens and Homo neanderthalensis. While again, the distinction between the class of pets and the class of useful animals is dependent upon very slight differences of habit and application, the difference of a cat and a dog is so profound that the microscope can trace it in a drop of blood or a single hair. When this aspect of the question is considered, it becomes understandable how nominalism had ultimately to abandon the idea that names were as insignificant as labels, and how out of a revised and amended nominalism there grew up that systematic attempt to find the true, the most significant and fruitful classification of things and substances, which is called scientific research. And it'll be almost as evident that while the tendency of realism, which is the natural tendency of every untutored mind, was towards dogma, harsh divisions, harsh judgments, and uncompromising attitudes, the tendency of earlier and later nominalism was towards qualified statements, towards an examination of individual instances, and towards inquiry and experiment and skepticism. So, while in the marketplace and the ways of the common life, men were questioning the morals and righteousness of the clergy, the good faith and propriety of their celibacy, and the justice of papal taxation, while in theological circles their minds were set upon the question of transubstantiation, the question of the divinity or not of the bread and wine in the Mass, in studies and lecture rooms, a wider-reaching criticism of the methods of ordinary Catholic teaching was in progress. We can't attempt here to gauge the significance in this process of such names as Peter Abelard, 1079 to 1142, Albertus Magnus, 1193 to 1280, and Thomas Aquinas, 1225 to 1274. These men sought to reconstruct Catholicism on a sounder system of reasoning. They turned towards nominalism. Chief among their critics and successors were Duns Scotus, around 1308 perhaps, an Oxford Franciscan, and to judge by his sedulous thought and deliberate subtleties, a Scotchman, and Ockham, an Englishman, around 1347 perhaps. Both these latter, like Averroes, made a definite distinction between theological and philosophical truth. They placed theology on a pinnacle, but they placed it where it could no longer obstruct research. Duns Scotus declared that it was impossible to prove by reasoning the existence of God or of the Trinity or the credibility of the act of creation. Ockham was still more insistent upon this separation, which manifestly released scientific inquiry from dogmatic control. A later generation, benefiting by the freedoms towards which these pioneers worked, and knowing not the sources of its freedom, had the ingratitude to use the name of Scotus as a term for stupidity, and we have our English word dunce. Says Professor Pringle Patterson, Ockham, who is still a scholastic, gives us the scholastic justification of the spirit which had already taken hold upon Roger Bacon and which was to enter upon its rights in the 15th and 16th centuries. Standing apart by himself because of his distinctive genius is this Roger Bacon, about 1210 to about 1293, who was also English. He was a Franciscan of Oxford, and a very typical Englishman indeed, irritable, hasty, honest, and shrewd. He was two centuries ahead of his world. says H. O. Taylor of him, "The career of Bacon was an intellectual tragedy, conforming to the old principles of tragic art, that the hero's character shall be large and noble, but not flawless, inasmuch as the fatal consummation must issue from character and not happen through chance. He died an old man, as in his youth, so in his age a devotee of tangible knowledge. His pursuit of a knowledge which wasn't altogether learning had been obstructed by the order of which he was an unhappy and rebellious member. Quite as fatally, his achievement was deformed from within by the principles which he accepted from his time, but he was responsible for his acceptance of current opinions. And as his views roused the distrust of his brother friars, his intractable temper drew their hostility on his head. Persuasiveness and tact were needed by one who would impress such novel views as his upon his fellows, or, in the 13th century, escape persecution for their divulgence. Bacon attacked dead and living worthies tactlessly, fatuously, and unfairly. Of his life scarcely anything is known, save from his allusions to himself and others, and these are insufficient for the construction of even a slight consecutive narrative. Born, studied at Oxford, went to Paris, studied, experimented, is at Oxford again, and a Franciscan, studies, teaches, becomes suspect to his order, is sent back to Paris, kept under surveillance, receives a letter from the Pope, writes, 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 his three best-known works, is again in trouble, confined for many years, released, and dead, so very dead, body and fame alike, until partly unearthed, after 5 centuries. The bulk of these three best-known works is a hotly phrased and sometimes quite abusive but entirely just attack on the ignorance of the times, combined with a wealth of suggestions for the increase of knowledge. In his passionate insistence upon the need of experiment and of collecting knowledge, the spirit of Aristotle lives again in him. Experiment, experiment, that's the burthen of Roger Bacon. Yet of Aristotle himself, Roger Bacon fell foul. He fell foul of him because men, instead of facing facts boldly, sat in rooms and pored over the bad Latin translations which were then all that was available of the master. "If I had my way," he wrote in his intemperate fashion, "I should burn all the books of Aristotle, for the study of them can only lead to a loss of time, produce error, and increase ignorance," a sentiment that Aristotle would probably have echoed could he have returned to a world in which his works weren't so much read as worshipped, and that, as Roger Bacon showed, in these most abominable translations. Throughout his books, a little disguised by the necessity of seeming to square it all with orthodoxy for fear of the prison and worse, Roger Bacon shouted to mankind, "Cease to be ruled by dogmas and authorities. Look at the world." 4 chief sources of ignorance, he denounced: respect for authority, custom, the sense of the ignorant crowd, and the vain, proud unteachableness of our dispositions. Overcome but these, and a world of power would open to men. Machines for navigating are possible without rowers, so that great ships, suited to river or ocean, guided by one man, may be borne with greater speed than if they were full of men. Likewise, cars may be made, so that without a draft animal they may be moved cum impetu inestimabili, as we deem the scythed chariots to have been from which antiquity fought. And flying machines are possible, so that a man may sit in the middle, turning some device by which artificial wings may beat the air in the manner of a flying bird.